And Mason goes, Liam's fallen in a crevasse. And immediately I'm just like, oh, like he's dead. Like, that's it. You know, we weren't roped up. He's just fallen.
Welcome to episode 3 of the World Entertainment Podcast, where we tell gnarly and entertaining wilderness adventure stories. Today, I am very glad to have two of my good friends from way over there, over in New Zealand. Two really strong mountaineers. I had the pleasure of doing some climbs with them out there. They're well known in their community out in Dunedin as some of the top mountaineers in their area. They're going to talk today about this story. When I heard it, I had to sit down, regroup, and then have a yarn, as they say in New Zealand, with my good friend Liam, who fell approximately, I'm going to say at least 6 stories into a crevice out in a glacier about 20 somewhat kilometers in New Zealand. So without further ado, my good friend Liam and Cameron.
The rope is free!
What?
The rope is free!
Liam's fallen into a crevasse, and I immediately thought he's dead, or at least seriously hurt.
And my guts had been ripped out of my body and were being contained by my flight suit.
I know a mountain lion is on top of me. All right. Welcome on board, gents. I am excited on this one because this is the first time we're going international. I've relocated this podcast to New Zealand for this episode, so I'm glad to have two of my good friends who I've, you know, had the experience of going on some pretty gnarly adventures with. Well, adventure, if you guys recall. And but let's talk about it. Let's talk about how one of you boys fell approximately 6 stories into a crevice. I'm going with 6 stories from the video I saw.
It's good. You have a video for it.
Yeah. So we were climbing this place on Aspiring, which is just like a wee mountain in New Zealand. It's the only 3,000er outside of the Mount Cook range. And yeah, we were walking on the glacier after like probably, I don't know, 26, 27 hours on the move.
About 26 hours.
Don't give away the punchline, Liam. We got to build up to this one because this is a pretty gnarly story. Let's start with, I want to describe a little bit of each of you guys' personalities. We need to understand who Liam and who Cameron Jardel is. So, and this is how I want to do this. I'm going to describe one of you guys, and I want the other person to tell me how accurate it is and to give any feedback or comment on the other person from my description. So the first thing, we're going to start with Liam Piot here. Liam, a chill guy. Nothing's really ever a big deal. That said, he's safety cautious. What do you say, Cam?
That's pretty good. I mean, yeah, I would definitely the chill thing and the safety conscious. Like, it's what we always strive for. So
yeah, like the man wants to get home. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the goal.
That's the goal.
Yeah. Now let's describe Cam and Liam. You're going to be the person giving some input on this. Cam's the I got this guy. He's the guy. He's the bold climber. He's the fast climber. His navigation is dialed, and he's usually got it on lockdown. Accurate or not?
Yeah, pretty accurate, I'd say. He's pretty optimistic sometimes, which is good. That's why we climb together.
There is a third person on our team during this climb, though.
Yeah.
For sure, and let's get into that. So, Cam is from, you're from Alaska, and Liam, you are a New Zealander. Now, you guys met like attending the University of Otago in New Zealand. That's how you guys got like started as these. At this point, I would label you guys as pretty renowned mountaineers in the community. You guys are part of the club. You're kind of running the show there.
For the university climbing, yeah. If not on a New Zealand scale, I wouldn't say.
No, I know. But like in the community, which like, first of all, that University of Otago is a huge school and Dunedin is the second biggest town or city on the south, on the South Island of New Zealand. So that's not saying nothing about you guys' reputation. And that's how I find, like, got in touch with you guys, is through that word of mouth. But let's dive into the story, because you guys are clearly itching to tell it. So let's start from the start, and like how long the approach into this mountain range is.
Oh yeah, so when we drove from Dunedin on what was like a Thursday night.
I don't know, it was early September, which is kind of like early spring, late winter down here.
Yeah, and so Mason had just hitchhiked to Dunedin. He's the other geezer who was on the climb with us. And he crashed at our place, and then we boosted off the next morning pretty early. And we got, it's like a 3.5 hour drive sort of thing from Dunedin to Wanaka. And then we crashed tonight in Cam's van in the car park there, and then set off pretty early the next day, probably around, I don't know, 6 o'clock or something. It was about a 10 hour walk to the base of the climb on where we bivvied on the glacier. And it was, yeah, like snowing a little bit, pretty white out, pretty cold. I remember getting up there and being like, fuck, this is real cold. But
there was this one point actually, and we had just set up our bivvies and the sun was kind of setting on the glacier, and like both of us were kind of just, you know, had our heads down, and you just hear behind us like, holy fuck. And Mason goes, is that what we're gonna climb? And we're like, yeah. And then the clouds came right in, and that was our only view for it, and then it was good night, you know. And that's the image we had going to sleep.
Wait, let's go back to like this 10 hour, just the 10 hour hike, because I've gone to Mount Aspiring, and like that's, you just kind of washed over this 10 hour hike, but it's pretty gnarly. It's kind of like, I mean, it's not insane, but you are doing some pretty steep hiking, climbing, scrambling, and you guys knocked this out in 10 hours. So, and like the entire approach is basically whiteout, is what you've just described.
Just once we were on to the glacier itself?
Yeah. So basically, the way you went up is different to the way we went up. So you went up, Bev and Cole, because you were heading to Colin Todd, whereas we took a track up to French Ridge, which is just another ridge that heads up to a hut up there. And then once we reached French Ridge Hut, there's no trail anymore, and that's basically when the snow starts. And so we, chucked crampons on and ice axes, got them out, and then we started boosting up straight from French Ridge Hut and just over what's called
Quarter Deck Pass,
which is just basically where the glacier starts, I would say, dropping down onto the Banana, which is the glacier around Mount Aspiring.
Yeah, but it's like what you experienced, where it kind of just gradually gets a bit gnarlier as you go, you know? Like you have probably 8 kilometers where you're just on flat track, and then suddenly, you know, you're in kind of like a steep route, you know, dense kind of forest, but going uphill. And then it all opens up and you're just on a long ridge line for another few kilometers. And then slowly, you know, the snow starts to build until you find yourself on the glacier and moving across that.
So let's build the scene here. Like, what was the objective here? What was the mission?
To climb the South Face of Spine.
Yeah, it was our first, face climb of this sort of level.
Yeah, it was very pushing our limits. Like, we had never done anything like this.
Yeah, and when you say face climbing, what the fuck does that mean?
So picture like a pretty steep, I don't know, you could describe it. If you looked at it from afar, you'd describe it as vertical. It's not quite vertical. It's a bit below vertical. And it's just like, you start at the bottom, you rope together, you go up, or the leader climbs while the other person belays below, and you climb a rope length, placing ice screws, cams, pitons. They're just different methods of protecting the rock and ice, I guess, to help you, just help arrest your fall if you were to fall. And then you get to the top. So the person builds an anchor, whoever was lead climbing. I led the first pitch, then Cam led a couple others after that, and Mason led a couple afters. But when you get to the top, you build an anchor, you belay the person up below you, then you do the same procedure.
So, like, I know what a pitch is, but just so people listening in, so a pitch of climbing is usually more or less the rope length that you're going to travel. So how many pitches or rope lengths was this climb on ice?
It was like 8 solid ice pitches, and then a pitch of snow, and then another pitch along the ridge to get to the summit. So 10 pitches in total.
And we soloed probably the first 80 meters at the bottom.
Oh, a bit more than 80 meters. It was like a solid third of the face, but it kind of like where we got onto the face was a bit low angle, and then it kind of took off. Yeah. So we were able to solo the bottom just to get a lot of, you make a lot of ground fast. And then once it got a bit steeper and more technical, then we switched to the rope climbing.
Gnarly.
Yeah.
And so like that, what was the most you'd had done at that time as far as pitches of ice climbing?
It's probably the Southwest Ridge of Aspiring the year previous. Because the reason this was quite big for us is like, you know, we started off just doing non-technical climbs. So, you know, just simple ice axe. You don't really need a rope other than when you're on a glacier. But it's kind of like, you know, ridge climbs that are less steep. And then you get into stuff where it's mostly that sort of, you know, just steep crawling. And then you get into a pitch where it's proper climbing like that. And then, but we had never done anything with multiple pitches in a row, you know, it had just been a one pitch here or there. And so this was pitch after pitch of steep climbing. And the difference really is just the commitment level of being on a face like that and knowing that, like, you can't just do one abseil and then kind of down climb. You kind of, you, if you were to reverse it, you'd have to do a lot of abseils to get back down.
And like myself being an ice climber, like, was the reality of getting out of there potentially doing like an ice anchor where you tread a V in the ice and then like your rope's going through that, or like you're, you know, leaving some little bits of rope and rappelling off of that and hoping the ice sticks?
So Cam might disagree with me a little bit on this, but I thought the pro was terrible. We were going up, pro was real minimal. So that's, again, the ice screws, the nuts, pitons, whatever you're putting into the ice or rock to protect yourself from a fall. I would very much doubt that a V-thread, which is putting that hole in the ice that you would abseil off, would hold. I wouldn't have been too comfortable wrapping off one of those. To put it in perspective, there were a couple times where we put an ice screw in and then yanked on the quick draw as a little bounce test, and the ice screw came out.
This is classic New Zealand alpine ice. You know, it's just thin.
And that's why I kind of, I love how you, like, both of y'all's personality, in a sense, is a little opposite, because Cam's always the guy, like, it's fine. Like, it's not a problem. But Liam's, on the other hand, is like, nah, it's really fucking not fine.
I don't know. There was some good rock break.
Yeah.
Would you say, Liam, would you say Cam ever gets summit fever?
I don't know about summit fever, but like, I mean, there was one climb recently where we did discuss climbing, soloing rock through the night, and Cam was definitely more keen for that than I was. he's not summit fevery. He's good to climb with.
No, I was saying, like, when we had our little, you know, climbing venture in Milford Sound, I recall like Liam being like, all right, I'm set, and Cam was like, dude, the summit's right there, like, we gotta go to the summit. And it was like dark, and I was kind of the tag along guy on this, that adventure, and I was like, whatever, top, no top, I don't care. And like, it was interesting watching that dynamic of both very strong mountaineer climbers, but just like Cam is so like driven all the time, and Liam's like, whatever, you know. It's probably a great relationship actually to have those like the two qualities out and about in like these real desolate environments.
Yeah, what you find is like it does work well, especially when we reach any sort of decision. You know, like where do we go? When do we go? And how do we climb this? And when we each offer kind of our own opinion or like our own like idea of how to get around an objective, it usually works out where you end up with two different perspectives that kind of come together and find something that works in between, you know, because I'll suggest something that he didn't really think of, and he'll suggest something I didn't really think of, and then you weigh the different options. You're like, oh yeah, either, oh, that works well, or no, that doesn't work well, or you find something in between. And that's really what's gotten us through this far, I think.
Yeah. All right, so back to the topic at hand. You're more or less 27 kilometers in, right? Usually, like, Mount Aspiring, that's where the base is located, right?
20 or so?
Yeah.
Something like that.
It's not quite as far as your one. It's just, It's sort of around the other side of the spiring a little bit.
We've probably done like 1,500 meters of vert so far just to get to the base of it.
Yeah.
Right on. So, and for those tuning in, I think that's, it's around like 14 miles probably to like your area. All right. So you're up there. You're up the pitches. Cam, what is your input as far as this gear that's like keeping you into the wall? What's your perspective on it?
It's like, it's not that the you can't find good gear. It's just the fact that it takes so long to find good gear. You know, you'd sit there. Like, I remember sitting at the belay and just being like, you know, shivering, being like, what is taking so long up there, you know? And you get up there and it's like 40 minutes to build an anchor because you just have to chop ice and rock away to find anything that'll work, you know? And then it's your turn on lead and you're like, all right, you speed. And you get up there and you get to the top and you're doing the exact same thing. And like time flies, you know, you think, you know, you're constantly trying to find pro and building as fast as you can. And next thing you know, it took 40 minutes to get it done. And that's what really kind of did us in on that climb was just, it took so long, you know?
So you guys hiked in, you started at 6 a.m. that first day. You said you camped before you actually started the ascent on the ice?
Yeah.
So we set up a bivvy and a crevasse, just like a little crevasse to protect ourselves from the wind and whatnot. It was actually quite windy that day. And so we set up bivvy there, had a wee feed and brought up some water for the next day. Then we woke up at, was it 3 a.m.?
Yeah, it was about 3.
3 a.m. the next morning to boil water, make some breakfast, and just sort of get all packed up and ready to go. Because our goal was to be at the bottom of the face on about sunrise.
Mm.
Gotcha. And how did that turn out?
Yeah, we got packed up. We actually got to the bottom of the face a bit early. So we stopped, got the jib boil out, made a cup of tea while we waited for the sun to rise, and just sort of enjoyed the view for a while. And then it was after that we started soloing.
All right, so 3 a.m. start, you're up there. How long did it take to get to the top of the ice?
18 hours.
Yeah, 18 hours to the summit from bottom to top.
And you can divide that by the number of pitches and realize that we weren't going very fast.
No.
So, all right. So like well over an hour a pitch. You get to the top. What time is it now? It's the next day or going on the next day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now you're going into the morning of the next day. And this is us getting down from the mountain, which our descent route was via the route you were going to climb up on the Northwest Ridge.
Yeah.
And so we kind of started working our way down that and then deciding we had a couple of different descent routes that we could have taken. And we ended up picking this one called the quarter deck, which is a bit
ramp.
Oh yeah. The ramp. Sorry. Which is kind of like a diagonal steep snow, but it's angled enough to where you can down climb it. You don't have to rope or abseil it.
It's quite dangerous. It's seen the most deaths on aspiring, but that to say it's not dangerous if you pick your time and you get your conditions right. So we had pretty optimal conditions, I'd say. It was a bit firm near the bottom, got a bit icy, and was sort of like, I don't know, neve ice down climbing.
It took us quite a bit longer than expected, though, because at this point in the climb, Liam had a bit of an ankle injury that was kind of ongoing. You want to explain that?
Yeah, so I hurt my ankle pretty bad on the piss one night. Yeah, I had a bit much to drink and I injured my ankle and it probably took, I don't know, like 3 or 4 months to heal. I can't really tell you what I did because I'm not too sure. And then so it sort of healed up pretty nice and I was keen to come on this climb. It was niggly still and I was like, fuck it, she'll be right. And so started on and it was probably about pitch five or six on the way up that it was pretty sore. And then coming down was a bit of a nightmare. I was very slow on the descent, so that didn't help very much.
So you're kind of limping your way out. All right, so you've down climbed, you have a fat ankle, you get to the base of the mountain. Now what? You're back on the ice field?
Yeah, we're back on the glacier now. At this point, it's probably like towards 6 a.m. now.
6 a.m. on like the second day, second and a half day?
Yeah, on the second day.
Yeah.
And at this point, there's like you talked about, there was a bit of new snow that came in, not a lot, but enough to where you were plugging, you know, and it was kind of slow. And so at this, yeah, so at that point, we had been going 26 hours. We were all really tired. And it was kind of like just, and with Liam's ankle, we were kind of stopping every 150 meters or so, 200 meters on the glacier, just to kind of rest and then keep going. And it was taking quite a while. And so, you know, I started going ahead to try and just kind of make a path through the snow so we could all just kind of, because we only had another, what, 3 or so kilometers to the bivouac site,
yeah,
to our camp. And at this point, we weren't roped up just because of we thought we understood the topography and the way that the glacier kind of flowed. And you can see a lot of like where the big ice fall is and where the big crevasses are. And we were kind of on a shelf that was it was pretty low angle, so we figured we'd be okay. So I started kind of pushing off ahead, and you know, the winds kind of sweeps across the top of a glacier and it just deposits snow in different weird ways. And so you could, there's also these sorts of like patterns on top of the glacier. And I got to this one point and I kind of looked at it and the pattern looked just a bit different, you know? And I was kind of like, you know, zombie state, 26 hours going. And I'm looking at it thinking, yeah, I don't know, it's just different. I don't really know why. So I decided, I was like, whatever. So I got on my hands and knees and crawled over it just cause I was just to try and distribute my weight better. Got to the other side of it, kind of realized like, I don't know what I'm, you know, I'm probably just delusional. Like it's nothing. So I just keep, and I keep going. And I've kind of got my eyes on this one point. And it's just like step after step, like just got to get to this point, and then I'll wait for the guys and we'll get to Biff.
And so I was following Cam's footsteps behind and I got to the point that he was talking about where he was on his hands and knees crawling across it. But to me, that looks like he had just stopped, turned around, looked to see if he could get eyes on us and see if we were still there, and then just kept moving. It didn't look like anything that I could see. I mean, there was possibly a little textural difference, but I was just following footsteps at the time. Mason was behind me, who's our other buddy who was with us. And so I just walk across it, and suddenly I'm just think I'm in a different place. I don't know what's going on. I don't really know how to describe it. I kind of just remember like a lot of snow and shit around me, a bit of compression on my chest and back from the crevasse, just kind of, it's like a wedge shape. Hit the bottom, couldn't move at all. I'll explain that in a bit. I was kind of looking around and going, what the fuck is going on? It was like, oh, it's dark, ice. Looked up and I could see one star above me. I was like, fuck, I know where I am. And then I had this conscious thought of, man, I'm way too calm for someone who's just fallen down a crevasse. And then I was like, right, try to start digging myself out. Because I had all that snow on that snow bridge had deposited on top of me. And I got buried up to my neck. If you know anything about like getting caught in an avalanche, I was trying to dig myself out. And it's because I just had this one arm, I was like rubbing myself. And all it was doing was smoothing the snow on top. And then it would refreeze. And so it was just like nothing was working. Couldn't move. At that point, I was like, okay, I'm not getting out of here. So I was like trying to get comms with Mason, who was up top. I was like yelling his name. Real weird thing happens in a crevasse. I can hear everything that goes on up top, but they can't hear me. So it took probably a wee while before we could get communication with Mason. And then, so what Mason has told me is he was trying to work out how to pull his PLB, which is a personal locator beacon. And that caused the helicopter to come and grab you, which is free in New Zealand. So it's not like a thing that you think about. You just do it. But he'd never pulled one before. So he was reading the instructions on the back. And then eventually he managed to hear me. And so he starts yelling at Cameron, 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 Cameron. Because Cameron had the other rope. I had one rope with me and Cam had the other rope. So Cameron starts running back. And yeah, I guess you can tell me what happened up top after that.
Yeah, I couldn't hear what he was yelling about, but I looked back and I could only see one head torch, and I was like, well, that's not right. There needs to be two head torches. So I started just running back as fast as I could until I got close enough, and Mason goes, Liam's falling in a crevasse. And immediately I'm just like, oh, like he's dead. Like, that's it. You know, we weren't roped up. He's just fallen. And then he's like, no, he's okay. He's, you know, but he can't move. He's stuck. And I was just like, it was a little moment of like, all right, we've got time to do something. You know, he's not running out of air, but we need to do this fast. And so I said, well, I'm on this side of the crevasse, and broke it, like the snow bridge just collapsed. So you just see this, like, oh, it's probably 3 meters across or two meters across.
Yeah.
At the top. And so, you know, we're trying to figure out like what kind of tools do we have to get down there? How are we gonna rescue him? And so Mason starts kind of throwing over stuff that he thinks might be helpful, like a snow stake, which is just like a long sort of metal thing you drive into the snow, and all sorts of different, like, you know, slings and things. And so he's just chucking it over the crevasse so I can start to build an anchor. And he suggests to bury the pack to make what's called a dead man. So you kind of like dig a pit, you put the rope around the pack, you bury the pack, and then that's all, then the weight of the snow kind of like keeps you, you know, that's your anchor. So I dig that, got the rope down there, and then got kind of like all the, you know, all the tools I would need. So a couple spare ice screws, a couple prussics, which you can use to ascend the rope back up. So like once I got down there and got Liam out, we both have to, you know, get back up the rope. Couple different mechanical devices and a shovel, to dig him out. And so I start abseiling into the crevasse, and I kind of locate him. And the way the snow had fallen, and the crevasse kind of kept going. The only reason he stopped was because, like you said, it constricts, and he stopped. But it gets skinnier and skinnier down below. And we realized that, like, if that were to, you know, become unstable again and fall, that was going to fall on both of us. And he was already, you know, neck buried up to his neck. So we kind of had to, you know, be very careful with what we were moving, but get him out of there fast.
Describe again, like, your arm sticking out. So you fell in and you're saying that you're trying to like clear the snow from above you?
Yeah. So the way Cam described it is, so yeah, there was the snow bridge fell on top of me while I was falling. And yeah, I got buried up to my neck, sort of side on. So I was like that under the snow with my feet being like here. And so I had my arm out and I was trying to dig that out, but because snow sits like concrete and you can't really move it by yourself, it just wasn't working. There was nothing happening. And that's when we got comms with Mason. And
what is your feeling as far as, like, I'm guessing you're kind of, you're pretty vulnerable at best, you know?
Nah, so that's what I mean, eh? Like, I kind of remember feeling like, I'm really calm. I know what's going on. I'm okay. There wasn't really a panic at all at that point. It was just like, this is what's happened. Right, let's get communication with Mason. Let's just deal with it. Let's get out of here, sort of thing. I'm okay. Yeah. It was bizarrely not scary.
And at no point did you ever feel like, kind of like 127 hours type situation where you're like, fuck, I might get stuck here. I might get like hypothermic, you know?
That came later.
Okay. All right. So at this point, it's simply problem solving.
Yeah, at this point, it's simply problem solving. At no point did I panic, but there was one point, which we'll get to, where I was like, right, let's call the helicopter and I don't know if we're getting out of here. And then probably 2 minutes later, I changed my mind and told Mason, no, don't do that.
So at that point, it became like, oh yeah, now what do we do? Mason had this really good idea actually to build a dead man anchor where I would dig sort of a pit in the snow and put the rope around the backpack and then bury the backpack. And that would sort of act as an anchor that I could abseil down into the crevasse on. And Mason was on the other side of the crevasse, and we weren't sure how far it went on either side, so he was pretty much stuck to his side, and I was stuck to mine. And so he was throwing over kind of useful tools that I might need, and I kind of gathered everything I needed, and then kind of abseiled down to the crevasse and found Liam down there, sort of, yeah, you know, buried up to his neck, probably about, oh, 0.8 of a meter wide because the crevasse sort of constricts a bit. So it's very tight, just these sheer ice walls. And there's kind of the way the snow bridge had fallen, it threatened to fall even more kind of onto us where from his position. So when I got down there, I immediately sort of was dug him out just enough to get his, kind of his armpits out. And I put a little piece of rope called a sling underneath his armpits and then tied it into the rope that I was on. Just in case the bottom fell out again, he would still be on to the system, you know, and he was considered safe. So he wouldn't fall any further. But, you know, as soon as we started moving snow around with a shovel, we quickly realized, like, it was quite tricky. Just, A, we didn't want to disturb the giant piece of snow that was kind of above him in case that was going to collapse. And B, it's just, like I said, it's so tight. You can't, you know, pick up snow and turn to dump it. It's you're like this and you can't really turn. So it was like kind of pushing it between the legs, and then I would kind of turn around and scoop it off down into the rest of the crevasse. This is a very, very slow process. Just trying to get him out.
Now like you turn around, Liam is in the crevice, and you realize, like, all right, I'm probably the person that has to figure out how to get him out. So Cam, how are you? What are your thoughts? Do you go into the "I got this" kind of mindset, or are you a little overwhelmed?
I was quite overwhelmed the moment before I knew that he could breathe, and that he was like physically, he didn't get hurt in the fall. You know, at that moment, it quickly became yeah, we can do this. We've got all the tools. We just need to execute it and figure out and figure out everything we need to do. Before that, it was a bit like, it was pretty hectic.
Had you practiced this like rescue system before, like this dead man with a pack that you described?
No. And that was Mason's idea, which is perfect, because I immediately started thinking about, well, all we have is a snow stake. You know, it's not going to hold very well in the soft snow. And then as soon as he was like, "You bury the pack," I was like, yes, that's the ticket.
The concept of a dead man's anchor with a pack, though, is very similar to what's called a T-slot with a snow picket. And we have done T-slots before. So a T-slot is just a dead man's anchor with a snow picket, essentially, except the surface area of a snow picket is like, it's something that long and like a piece of metal like that wide. So a pack is obviously much greater surface area, which in softer snow means it's going to stay more solid.
Yeah. All right. So you're in there, Cam, with your little shovel, and you're slowly unburying Liam. What's the next step?
Well,
I guess one thing about the shovel thing is, and digging me out. So this took about 2 hours. For him to dig me out took about 2 hours, and that was because of how slow it was moving the snow. And once we got down to my feet, because my boots are super rigid, and it's just you've got that right angle, it took so long to get the last bit out because my ankles can't bend and I can't point my toes. So we had to dig myself right down to my boots, and it took so long for that last little bit. So after we'd dug us out, which was the majority of it, it was like, okay, let's ascend the rope, which Cam used a prusik to get up. And a prusik is just a friction hitch, like a knot essentially, which you tie that you can loosen and slide up the rope. But when you weight it, it'll grip the rope and bite. And so you have two of them, one for your foot and one for your harness. So you stand in the one on your foot, push the one on your chest up, sit in your harness, pull the one for your foot up, stand on it again and push it up. And that's how you do it. It's instead of going hand over hand on the rope, which doesn't work very well.
So we try to get Liam up first on his prusiks that he had in his harness, but they were frozen. And so I had to go up first because the way I rigged the rope, you couldn't do it with a mechanical ascender. I don't know why I didn't do it like that in the beginning, but I had to go up first and then fix the rope. And then he used the mechanical ascenders that we had to get up.
Were you mobile, Liam? Because you just spent 2 hours in the snow. What's your body operating like?
I said that I was pretty keen to call the heli at one time. That was because it was taking so long to get me out, and I was worried about hypothermia because I was very cold. I was shivering uncontrollably, not pretty with it still, but bordering on sort of entry stages of hypothermia. And so I was very much like, right, we need to get out of here. Let's call the helicopter. The reason I told them not to in the end, because I was like, by the time the helicopter mobilizes and gets here, it's going to be another couple of hours. And by that time, I'm already screwed. You know, I'm well into hypothermia. It's about negative 20 Celsius-ish. So it's pretty cold. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but...
I don't know myself. I think around the tens or something, low fives,
yeah, probably something like that.
Yeah,
so it's pretty cold. And we're just kind of, yeah, so I was mobile, but I wasn't at my best, you know.
Now, but you're still able to ascend this rope and get out of there.
Yeah.
All right, but the problem with this story is that you're 27 kilometers in the New Zealand outback. I mean, you know, you're way out there. So the story doesn't end. What comes next?
Yeah, so we got up to the rope, and then it was kind of like, right, let's get to the bivvy and we'll make a plan from there. Because I just needed to get moving. All I wanted to do was get moving so I could get some blood flowing and get warm again.
Well, it was sunny at this point. The sun had arisen while we were in the crevasse. You know, it's probably about 8 o'clock in the morning now. And so just getting into the sun and moving around seemed to be the best.
Yeah. I just didn't want to stop, basically. Because if we stopped, that's when things could have gone wrong, froze up. So we hiked back the next K and a half, 2K through the snow to where we bivvied. And then I was pretty out of it then. I guess I let you explain the...
Yeah, Mason and I kind of ended up packing up camp, and we ended up kind of getting... It was a bit of... We took about probably an hour where we had some food and water, melted some snow for some water, had some tea, and just kind of like, you know, assess the situation and kind of like reflected on the whole climb and the rescue. And, you know, we had the sun on us now, so everything kind of felt okay. And Liam kind of just went into this like semi-lucid state... where, you know, he's just sitting on his pack, kind of like, if you said Liam, he wouldn't respond, but like he was moving and kind of mumbling. So we just kind of like let him sleep for a second, picked up everything else, and then got Liam up. And this time we roped up and ended up getting back across the glacier, hiking back down to the French Ridge Hut, which was, where we finally stopped to have a sleep. After 34 hours, I think.
Yeah, so So we hiked across the glacier and back down into French Ridge Hut. That went pretty smoothly. Mm. I kind of fell asleep once standing up, which was pretty weird. But I don't know, woke up pretty quick and just kept going. So we boosted up the quarter deck, back down to the glacier. Then we stopped. I had an assignment to hand in at uni the next day, so we only slept for 2 hours at the hut because we were like, right, we got to get out of here. So we stopped. This is like 30 hours on the go, I think. Yeah. Slept for 2 hours, packed up, and then boosted back out the valley for another 10K, 15K, something like that.
Mm. I'm tired just listening to this. What's the morale like? Because I hear in like these, because at this point, let's not lie to each other, you're basically in a survival situation. What's the morale like in the hike out?
It was actually pretty good.
Yeah, once we were back in the sun and we kind of got over it and Liam was back, you know, animated, it was pretty good. We actually went and we had a bowl down at the hut and kind of reassessed the situation, and then had a quick nap. You know, and that just kind of re-energized us. But the worst morale was probably like the last 4 kilometers back to the car.
Man.
Because, you know, the sun had set again, and it's just like you're on a path and you're sore and tired, and it sucks. You know, that's the last bit. When you know you're so close, but it's just like.
We must have stopped.
We stopped quite a long
time. Every half hour, something like that. Just to sit down for 5 minutes and talk about how much it sucked, have a wee giggle about how much it sucked, and then get up and keep going.
Yeah.
The best thing about it is the guys I was with and all of us, we could still laugh about it, you know? Mm. We could be like, man, this is awful, but hey, it's one hell of an experience.
Yeah.
At least we got to practice our skills, you know?
Let me ask this question because I spoke with your cousin Liam before starting this podcast, and he wanted me to ask, what was the dumbest decision you guys made out there?
Just not roping up.
Not roping up.
On Glacier. We thought we understood the topography. We thought we understood the glacier. And it's just like, there's so many little things that you can't predict. You know?
I do have a bit of a background on why we thought what we thought with the glacier.
Mm.
So I'm not going to name drop anyone because I don't want to do that. But there's a guy that we used to climb with quite a bit. We don't climb with anymore purely because of he's moved place and all that. He's still a great guy and everything. But that's, he's sort of been like the banana glacier in winter when it looks like this, there's not really much point roping up. Mm. We'd heard that from other people as well. A couple of older climbers, they're like, yeah, the banana's perfectly safe. The previous year, same time of year, we didn't rope up completely fine. Mason, who the other guy we were with, he went out a couple months ago now, and he reckoned there was about 10, 15 parties on the glacier, and he reckoned half of them weren't roped up. It's one of those places that people definitely underestimate, I believe.
Mm.
So that's our little background on why we didn't rope up at that point. That's something we've learned from and won't do again, though.
Now, like, so kind of the purpose of the podcast is to tell these incredible wilderness stories as well as oftentimes these survival stories. What would you, you know, what would you recommend to somebody in a, you know, in one of these survival predicaments like you were in where you're kind of helpless? What is the mindset to approach like these problems with?
I reckon it's just important to be like, everything's all good. You know, you just take one little task, you deal with it, you move on. Don't think of the big picture. It's all about being there now. And one thing goes wrong, deal with it, move on to the next thing that's wrong, and just keep going from there. Very much just small tasks, do it over and over again, and then eventually a big task gets done.
That's a great, like, that's a great thing that we keep preaching as far as, you know, I also run the Rescue Swimmer Mindset podcast, and that's basically how we coach individuals to make it through these tough military like type trainings or any type of athletic endeavors or objectives that they have is, yeah, really just break it down. Like if you're looking at like what you're hoping to get at the end of the road, it's a long road. But if you're just looking at the pavement at your feet, then, you know, just take the next step. I think the other awesome part, and this kind of goes back into Cam's character, is didn't you just take the steering wheel right after that and you drove back to the, what is it, 6 hours back to Dunedin?
I did, yeah. Yeah, 6 hours back to Dunedin, got in the next morning and just slept. But I'll tell you, that was probably the most dangerous part of the whole trip. And if there's one thing that, you know, there's a lot of things that we took away from that, but like, I don't drive like that anymore. I usually just, you know, if it's that far into not sleeping, it will just sleep in the car.
Yeah, so Mason and I, this is quite funny. Mason and I were like, right, okay, Cam's going to drive. Let's take 20 minutes each. So you nap for 20 minutes, I nap for 20 minutes. And the whole time we're meant to be trying and talking to Cameron. It didn't work, man. I'd wake up after my 20-minute nap. Mason would be asleep, and I'm thinking, shit, right, okay. Hey, Cam, how's it going? Blah, 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 blah. Talk to him for 20 minutes, wake Mason up. Sometimes that would happen. Sometimes I'd fall asleep talking to him. It just didn't work.
But we got there, you know? Just get wired and go.
And didn't you attend classes, like, didn't you have, like, it wasn't an exam week for you, like, basically?
No, yeah. I had an assignment due, so I had to go to a tutorial the next day at, like, I think it was, like, 10 a.m., 11 a.m. So I went in there after, I think, what time did we get back? I think we got back at, like, 6 a.m. Yeah. So I had 4 hours until I had 3 hours kept, then boosted off to my tutorial to hand my paper, and I didn't go to classes, though, for, like, the next 3 days after that.
So we saw a lot of sunsets, though, on that trip.
Yeah. Hey, listen, it's a gnarly story. I really appreciate you guys telling that story. Let's leave it with Cam. What would be like one of your recommendations for anybody finding themselves in such a predicament?
Assess the tools. I think the very first thing I did was kind of just take out everything that I thought I might need for this rescue. You know, one, you have to figure out your time constraint and act on that. And once we realized we had a bit more time, we was like, okay, dial into exactly how we're going to do this. And I just took down everything that I thought I could possibly need. And I think, yeah, that's quite important, is being able to recognize what you need to do and use the tools that you have to do it.
It's awesome. Hey, thanks for coming on to the Wheel Entertainment podcast. Hopefully you guys have some, actually, I don't know. I was going to say, hopefully you guys have some more gnarly stories to come and I can have you guys on again, but it sounds a little risky. So
we've gotten better. We've gotten better. All right, boys. Yeah. Thanks for having us, Vinny.
Yeah.
All right, boys.
Cheers, man.
Yeah. I'll talk to you soon.